Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's November 20th, 2022, and welcome to episode 261 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and catching up with all of the things. I'm Paul Hagstrom, near Boston. I am joined today by two retro computing enthusiasts, the first of whom on my screen is Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
I am fine. I am also relatively near Boston, like depending on what you compare it against.
It's true. Jupiter.
Compared to Jupiter, I am really close to Boston.
That's right. Also joining us is Quinn Dunkey from the wilds of the Northwest. Where are you? For some reason, I can never quite seize this. British Columbian woods.
The wilds of British Columbia, but you can just say British Columbia if you don't want to, you know.
It's mostly wilds.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
It's all wilds up here.
Okay.
There's Vancouver, and then it's just there be dragons.
There's Vancouver and crazy mountain people. Guess which one Quinn is?
Yes. Whole sections of it are just unmapped. We don't know. It's trees and stuff.
Excellent.
Canada has two things, trees and stuff.
That's right.
So we were in the process of kind of going through, as our episode numbers increased, sort of talking about the year that was something like related to the last two digits of the year. So we're on episode 261. The year we would be talking about is 1961, and nobody could find anything that happened in 1961. So, but we have a lot of feedback, so I think we might just do that, unless anyone wanted to pitch in their favorite 1961 fact.
Well, and to be fair, we didn't try that hard, but you know, you get what you pay for with this show.
I tried really hard, but I failed. That's the difference between Quinn and I. I just failed.
But okay, so let's see. So there's a ton of feedback. I don't think I'm going to go through it all. I know I'm not. Stefan posted something on our Facebook page. Somebody made a neural net on a Commodore 64, which is pretty crazy. So this is on a Formulab.ch site, John Walker's site, who now that I'm saying this out loud, I realize I didn't check this, but I think he is founder of Autodesk Inc. and co-author of AutoCAD. So wow. has
some
street
credentials.
Yeah. He writes, this is my most outrageous excursion into Commodore 64 programming. It is a complete neural network associative memory pattern recognizer implemented in fewer than 250 lines of BASIC. It's still running. But yeah, no, it was an interesting thing. We've gotten a fair amount of interesting activity on the Facebook group. So Facebook being the only the third worst social network now.
That's hard to keep track. Well, soon it might be promoted to second worst again, just by, you know, everyone.
Yeah.
Everyone moving up a slot when one of them goes away.
Right.
It's bonkers to me that somebody could do any form of neural network on any vintage computer, C64 or otherwise. Like, that's just doesn't seem okay.
See, I was actually going to just say the opposite.
Really?
So of course, this is awesome. The example there.
Wait, do you have 26 points to make? A, this is awesome.
Yeah. No, it's just reverse Canadian. It's like, you know, this is awesome, eh?
Two, no, I don't. Now, so Roman numeral three, what I was going to say was that, first of all, on the screen here is a recognizing number glyphs, which is really cool. It's a great little test case. But the point I was going to make is that at their in their most basic form, neural networks are actually really, really simple. Like it's literally just a couple of small matrices of floating point numbers that you multiply the weights together. And, you know, the output neuron is either, you know, above 0.5 or below 0.5. So they're actually very, very simple. And with just that, you can do basic things like recognize a pattern of, you know, 8x8 pixels, for example, and judge whether that pattern is more or less like an apple or more or less like an A or whatever. So I think because of that, retro computers are actually a really good fit for this kind of thing because you can start so small. Of course, you can scale them up tremendously. Modern machine learning is the same idea scaled up to just a bonkers degree. But at their core, a basic three-layer neural network could absolutely be implemented on very little hardware. So
that is cool. Fascinating.
Yeah. I'd be interested to know, I guess he did it in BASIC, so I assume the weights are floating point, but you could also do it in fixed point assembly for actually quite a bit of speed then. It looks like it's BASIC, so I assume it's... Does Commodore BASIC have floating point? I'm not actually sure. Where's Earl when you need it?
It must. I think Commodore BASIC is, it's like AppleSoft. It's, you know, Microsoft derived.
It's not, though. That's the thing, because Jack, what's his name? The guy... I'm losing all my Commodore points right now. The Commodore guy was really cantankerous and refused to license Microsoft BASIC. And so they went off and wrote their own, right? Or no, they refused to upgrade it or something. He got the initial one.
Trammell.
Yes. Jack Trammell, thank you. Yeah, they got an early version, but then they refused to upgrade it, which is why Commodore BASIC was sort of always far way behind everybody else's, and they never changed it for years and years and years. There's a story there anyway about how Jack refused to give Bill Gates money. But anyway, I guess I don't know. Inconclusive as to whether it has a floating point. I'm sure we'll get email, but I think the story is that Jack got an early version of Microsoft BASIC for a one-time fixed fee. And then after that, Bill Gates refused to do that deal with anybody else. So after that, it was licensing fees for everybody. And Jack refused to do that. So they never got any updates to their BASIC. And then That's why it was just sort of clunky its entire life.
A quick Google search tells me that on the C64 wiki, that yes, C64 is built-in BASIC interpreter, does have subroutines for performing stuff on floating point. So you can use real numbers. Yeah.
Good.
Excellent.
Good for it.
Yeah.
All right. So that's cool. I will go back and talk about this. Also on this Formulab site, there's a history and nostalgia section. What we were just looking at was in the Commodore Curiosities section, but there is, let's see if I can find it here, UNIVAC memories. And in the UNIVAC memories, there is -0. And this is actually a pretty good overview of kind of like one's complement. So we talked on episode 256 and a couple times since about two's complement and one's complement. And I think at some point it was mentioned that having a plus and a -0 causes math to be crazy complicated. And somebody took issue with that. Essentially, I think the point was that it's sort of equally complicated. But anyway, it's pretty interesting reading through this kind of overview of how people used plus and minus zero. So because it was available on these earlier machines, on the UNIVAC, Sperry, Unisys 1100, 2200 type machines, people did, you know, like used them for things. And it sort of goes through what the problems are with having two zeros and how you can kind of get around it. But there are problems if you are one of the people who like programs in these, you know, 1100 systems. Sometimes when you expect something to be zero, it turns out it's actually -0 and doesn't, you know, trip the flag and whatever. And so you have to be sort of careful. You have to, load the value and then add zero in order to make sure that it is a positive zero and so forth. But
this chart here of -0 logic,
yeah,
I feel like that's trolling me. Like that looks like one of those joke programming languages that people write.
Yeah. +0 + +0 = +0. But -0 + -0 = -0.
I'm really glad I never had to learn that.
Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, so Lewis wrote to talk about that and pointed us to this article. And Garrett also wrote, who had written before about the fast rounds in UNIVAX, and also gave some, maybe I'll put the links in the show notes, but some links to the 2200 and UltraSys 2200 architecture and stuff like this. There's a bunch of stuff there that predates anything I have ever learned. But actually, yeah, Lewis, when he wrote, actually said, sort of encouraged me not to take too seriously this idea that it's big and difficult and old and well beyond anything we knew, because it's actually once you start getting into it, it's a little bit more, it's more familiar than you'd think. So I do still intend to look at that a bit. But anyway, that's another thing that's on formulab.ch. So I think it might actually be interesting to look through this entire site at some time.
Yeah, that minus zero page actually looks really cool. That's a strong recommend of a read for anyone who's interested in one's complement and why we didn't end up with it, what the challenges are. Looks really good.
Okay, so let's see. We had, let's jump to, I think we talked about this before, so maybe very quickly just talk about, does this seem familiar? It's a BBC archive video that's sort of behind the scenes at Infocom in 1985. So it is a, 8-minute video that just, sort of interviewing people at Infocom as they, make text adventures.
No, but this is very interesting to me. Yeah, I want to subscribe to your newsletter.
Yeah, this is awesome. I've never seen this.
Huh. Yeah. I sort of feel like we talked about it before, and yet when I was skimming through the video, it didn't feel familiar. So this Herb posted this on the Facebook page.
Yeah, this looks news to me. This is great. Wow, they're showing their QA documentation and stuff.
All right, so we can
really, really cool.
Look and see.
This is the kind of stuff that you want to know about how these old game companies worked, and you never see it because nobody kept records of any of this stuff back then. Nobody thought it mattered. That's really neat. And everything was on paper, so it's all been lost.
Right, right. Either in a flood or just through being tossed out.
Yeah, exactly. Excellent. That's really neat.
Oh, I'll be watching that. I cannot wait to watch this. I am fascinated.
Let's wrap up this recording. Exactly. I want to watch. All right.
Go watch it right now. Yep. I'm so anxious to see it.
Another thing that Herb posted to the Facebook was a Reuters story. So these are big news companies or whatever. Quite recent, a month ago, I guess, talking to a floppy disk retailer saying, it says, floppy disk supplier says business is booming. And has a little video of his operation and just sort of talking about the fact that, lots of airplanes and things, rely on floppies, which is not great news.
I did see this story. I dug into this a little bit when it first went around, and as far as I could tell, he's just he's getting new old stock and he's collecting. He's sort of absorbing the remaining floppy disk inventory of the world into one place is what he's doing. So there's nobody still making them. He's not manufacturing them. Especially the 5 1/4. I think 3 1/2, there's probably still somebody making them, but certainly not 5 1/4 or 8-inch. So he's just sort of accumulating remaining stock. But what that means is that, yes, you can get them, but who knows if they're going to work and for how long. I think that's the challenge here.
And he is now the official single point of failure for floppy disks.
Yeah,
first
exactly.
There's a fire or flood, the world's supply is wiped out.
Yeah. I think we've talked a bit before about that infamous Atari guy. There was that guy who bought up the remaining parts and supplies of all Atari 8-bit stuff. And so everybody who wanted anything Atari had to go through this guy, and he was a bit of a soup Nazi. If he didn't like you, he'd cut you off. And some of the stories were maybe exaggerated. But anyway, this guy, I think, is turning into that for floppy disks. He's going to be the sole source of them now because he's cornering the market that remains. It is interesting that anytime a technology reaches end of life, there's always going to be an opportunity for this guy, Sun Remarketing or whatever, that bought up all the leases, when that was shut down. Or, there's always going to be opportunity to be the last one, I think, which is surprisingly lucrative. You can capture, because every technology has a long tail. And if you're the only supplier and thus can capture all of that long tail, it's going to add up. So even if there's only, you know, a couple thousand people on Earth still using whatever 5 1/4s for something important, well, he's going to be the only guy. So that's a real business.
Yeah, 5 1/4s in particular are hard to come by.
Yeah, they were on that cusp of like not lasting very long and not made very well. Like they were sort of mass produced in a way that like 8-inch floppies, I think, last better because they were made a little better and they were lower density, so they were a little more robust. But that and the high, some of the high density 3.5s are really bad too. Like especially like you can go on Amazon right now and buy 3.5-inch high density discs, which presumably were made fairly recently, and they're terrible. Like I've bought a few of them and they go bad in 3 months. So clearly the manufacturing quality has fallen off as demand has dropped.
Yeah, I always have that sort of suspicion that there's kind of like a middle era. Like when discs were first made, they were, you know, they didn't know how to do it, and then were made well, and then they were made fast.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, and with the new 3.5s that you can buy now, you can really see where they're cutting the corners. Like the plastic is cheaper and it's thinner. So like the new 3.5s I bought, like they're really quite flexible, and the plastic feels strange. Like they're using some kind of garbage plastic. They're not the satisfying, chunky, robust 3.5s that we remember. They're pretty terrible now.
They're made out of recycled McDonald's playgrounds or whatever,
<That's> exactly.
Which themselves were made of recycled plastic.
Yes.
Okay, let's see. The next one, Norman wrote, posted this on Facebook, pointed this out. This is Lotus 1-2-3 for Linux. It's kind of a funny little tale here. It's Tavis Ormandy. It says, I really like Lotus 1-2-3 and was basically, you know, looking at the problem of getting add-ins for it. And apparently there was a Linux version of Lotus 1-2-3 briefly, but it didn't survive. And the only only way that it was resurrected was through some like pirate site. Anyway, it's I'm not even sure that I completely grasped the whole story, but essentially what ended up happening is the person got this a bunch of Teledisc images of Lotus 1-2-3, and in it there was a large symbols file. Like something that would sort of allow linking to modules that were not all flavors of Linux could link to or something, and so it basically just allowed insight into the, kind of like the internal workings of the program to the point where it could be brought up on current Linux and have you know the plugins work or whatever. So anyway, this is something that basically one person is interested in, but it's fun to see like the entire saga.
Yeah, I like that he in the intro he says it's an exciting time in the Lotus 1-2-3 enthusiast community. Wait, that was a joke. There is no enthusiast community. It's just me.
we should clarify a little bit there, because at the top you said that there was briefly a version of 1-2-3 for Linux. That's
for
technically
Unix.
Not true. Yeah, there was a System 5 version, and he's porting the System 5 version to Linux, which is a horrible bastard love child of 10 different Linuxes, or of 10 different Unixes, and yes, I'll say it again, Linux ruined Unix, but this is pretty cool.
Yes, sorry, that is, it actually makes a lot more sense, too, of what the project was, because it really is a port from something to something.
Yeah, well, and I was struggling there, because I was like, wait, did 1-2-3 last long enough to overlap with Linux? Because Linux is pretty new, and this is pretty old, but System 5 makes sense, so I could see why they took a brief shot at putting it out on that market.
Okay, so now the time has finally come where we can talk about the Commodorian.
This thing is amazing. It really is amazing.
Yeah, several people wrote into us about this. So you've seen it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, this went wide. Yeah. So he created, he's an accordion enthusiast and a retro computing hobbyist, which is a delightful Venn diagram overlap. And so he created an accordion with two Commodore 64s. Now, what's amazing about this is that it's the real deal. So it's using air pressure like an accordion to control volume, and it's generating the sound with the SID chips in the Commodore. This is not some cheap stunt. So the way it works is he has an air pressure sensor inside the bellows that controls the volume on the SID chips. And so that's, so it plays and acts just like a real accordion, and the sound is legit being generated by the SID chips. And not only that, so he, okay, you build this crazy contraption, but if you look at it, it's extremely difficult to play because it's like unwieldy, and you've got a full keyboard under both hands because there's a Commodore on either side of the bellows. So then he taught himself to play this monstrosity, and he plays it extremely well, and it looks extremely difficult to play, and so he spent time doing that. And then, of course, the pièce de résistance is that the bellows are actually made of floppy disks that he cut up and made into an accordion. So it's hard to think of any way you might improve this, honestly. It's pretty amazing.
It is pretty wild.
And it's worth watching the video to see him play it, because it's actually pretty good, and he's quite good at playing it. So it's so much more than the cheap stunt that you suspect it might be at first glance.
Yeah, and it the way the air, if I understood it right, the way the air works is that he's got a little, like a microphone in there that's sensing wind going by it.
Yes, yeah, that's right, yeah.
And he has an envelope follower, and so like the more wind, you know, the more amplitude, the louder the volume gets turned up.
Yeah. So good. It's just, yeah, attention to detail. He really tried to do it legitimately and not just, like, because anybody could have taken a couple of empty shells and thrown an Arduino in there, and, you know, the bellows wouldn't do anything. They'd just be for looks or whatever. But no, it's using the real equipment start to finish.
Yeah, it's set up so that like on one side it's playing notes, and on the other side it plays chords, or it does rhythm.
Yeah, and I mean, he's using a lot of keys on both sides. Like, it's very impressive to watch him play those things.
Yeah,
I can imagine that took some practice, and it's got to be heavy too, because the insides of it, there's a lot of wood in it. He's used a lot of lumber in the construction of it, so the thing must be heavy.
Yeah, he did comment on that, actually. It's that's one of the downsides.
Yeah, I love it. It's kind of, I'm sure many people have seen Jerry Ellsworth's guitar that she made out of a Commodore.
Mm-hmm.
Also similar in that it, you know, was legit. It used the SID to produce the sound and everything. So this is kind of like a spiritual successor to that, if you will.
There's soon going to be a whole band. We got to get those two together.
Yeah.
Seriously. There's a polka waiting to happen here.
Yep.
They're going to open for Weird Al.
Yeah, right. I'm not sure. This guy also, he has a way with the names. He had a prior/related project called the 64-gun.
That is a great name.
Yeah.
I'm starting to suspect he comes up with funny portmanteaus of Commodore 64 first, and then figures out what project could have that name.
Right, exactly.
Either way, I support it, but...
It's pretty excellent. Let's see. So much feedback. Thank you, everybody, for all the feedback. We got tweeted at by Compiler Explorer. I don't know...
Wait, is Twitter still a thing?
It is. Well, at least at time of recording.
When was this recorded?
May not be that long.
I wonder if it'll still be a thing when this show comes out. It'll be pretty funny if this bridges that gap.
So Compiler Explorer, the interesting thing that, you know, the reason we were tagged in the tweet was that the Z88DKC compiler was added, and JS Speccy for ZX Spectrum emulation and Miracle for Sega Master System emulation was added. I don't know that much about this, but it looks like one of kind of a genre of sort of browser-based IDEs where you put in code and it will compile it and then run it through emulator. If I refresh, I think it will. Yes, there's a I can click here to emulate, and it will pop up an emulator and run the thing. And so it's kind of cool if you actually want to do some in-browser retro development.
So it's sort of compiling real time as you type code in the left half and then showing you what it compiles to in the right half, and then you can then run that code? Is that what it's doing?
Seems like it.
That first view you showed had C code on one side and then the compiled assembly version of, on the other, so I wondered if it was doing that kind of real timey, which I suppose nowadays we have the power to do, so that would be neat if you were wanting to learn about how compilers work.
And I think this, so I think this actually does more modern things. I think this is a sort of a modern IDE, but a couple of retro things have been put in it. So anyway, it's one of these things that I would kind of like to play with. And the nice thing about this is that you don't have to install something. You just like go to the web page, and it is possible to somehow link to data that's there somewhere. I mean, I don't know where it's stored exactly, but
these browser-based IDEs have really gotten quite impressive. The only thing keeping me from using them is that you have to have an internet connection then, and so that rules out working on airplanes and some other scenarios like that. But
yeah. When a lot of us do most of our retro stuff.
Yeah, frankly, yeah, because it's nice to have that to work on when you have no other thing that you can do, since everything else requires internet. But right. Yeah, these things are really cool. I mean, it is nice to have, it's nice how integrated they are, like from line of code to fully running emulator, especially the Commodore ones, like some of the C64 ones that they have are really amazing. And you know that the emulator is going to work properly with the code that you wrote, because the same person kind of integrated all of it together. Mm-hmm. And you don't have those dances that we always have to do of making disk images and trying to get them to launch in the emulator and then finding out that the emulator doesn't support this or that or whatever. So yeah, it's nice to have it all integrated like that.
Feedback continues. Let's see, who's this? This was Tony. Tony emailed us to tell us about, where is it? The Computer History Museum's list of upcoming source code releases. So in December, we will have Adobe PostScript. And in January, we will have the Lisa source code. I guess it's coinciding with the 40th birthday. I guess that's right. Yeah, right. 2023. March, we'll have the Alto.
Open sourcing PostScript is sort of ironically timed with the locking down of Pantone, which has been quite the kerfuffle among the art community right now.
Yes, indeed. It certainly is. My goodness. It's messing with me.
And I have, this is the first I've heard of that.
I guess it's a bit off topic for our show, so we don't have to go into it. But basically, Pantone decided that they own color now, and you have to buy their plugin in order to use Pantone colors in Adobe products. And if you don't, then all of your artwork is black when you open it.
Cool.
And it was a pretty terrible thing to do. Here we are. But sort of more related to the topic, that then, of course, immediately triggered an open source version of Pantone, which now exists and has all the same colors and all the same codes. It's I think it's called Open Tone or Samson Tone or something for the guy that created it. So It's hilarious, because trying to own color is pretty ridiculous, and it's just about the easiest thing in the world to replicate and open source. So yeah, they did. So.
Except the problem is, like, Pantone is mostly used when it comes to print, like you're mixing inks.
Mm-hmm.
And like,
right.
Otherwise, why even touch it? You're going to play in a different gamut. Like, who cares? Yeah. But if you play in the CMYK, which is really just for inks, then yeah, you want to send something off to get printed God knows where in the world. And the only way to know, hey, my logo is going to look like I want it to or whatever, is people pick the Pantone stuff. And it is messing with a whole bunch of projects that I have underway, and people get like, you know, materials created in China, and they're like, I don't know what your green is going to look like now. I was like, yeah, but because trying to get my clients to just pony up and pay for it is, I'm like, oh, your stuff's going to be different if you don't do that. It's a hassle. So anyway, it's outside of the retro world, but it's causing momentary major hassles with production.
So the shtick with the Open Tone, though, is that they use the same codes. So you can say, oh, it's Steve Tone 604C, and then the printer is going to know, oh, okay, I know what 604C is.
Yeah.
So they're kind of, it's sort of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge sort of situation. But
it's interesting. I would have actually thought that this could hurt Pantone, you know, because now, like before, people might like try to be benevolent or whatever and say, like, yeah, you did a service. We will honor that service. But now, you know, if you're just going to try to lock it down, then we're going
to
go with Steve Tone.
Just wants
Steve
to make
Tone.
More money. They only get so much in licensing from the ink manufacturers and stuff. So I think they're like, hey, everyone uses our stuff forever. Let's lock it down. And and it's going to be a whole big copyright kerfuffle, because like a lot of the Pantones are, it's a copyrighted thing. Like there's a Pantone for Tiffany's, and it's like they own that color, and Pantone is licensed to use it. And so you can't, so everyone's afraid to use the other sources, because like, well, what if it doesn't exist? I don't know. Anyway, it's outside of the realm of retro stuff, but it's causing headaches for the last few weeks.
It's classic rent seeking, and I think it's going
to
backfire, because
100%
rent seeking usually does, especially nowadays when it's so easy to pirate and copy and open source this kind of stuff. So we'll see.
There is also a previous source code releases the Computer History Museum has had, and we've talked about a bunch of them, but so like Eudora and Apple TDOS and Photoshop and stuff.
I see Deluxe Paint in there. That's cool. That, I mean, talk about, since we're talking about Adobe, talk about revolutionary products. It's hard to overstate the impact that Deluxe Paint had on computing. I mean, it was the standard for computer game art for decades. Hmm. I mean, Amiga people still use it because it's such, so perfectly tailored to making a certain style of 16-bit artwork. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, well, I hope people do look at this. I mean, like, I look at this and kind of want to look at it, but I'm not sure that I actually do. So Tony wrote to point out an obituary of Kathleen Booth. And the thing that was sort of notable about this, so this is October 29th, 2022, so quite recently. And it's interesting because it says the inventor of assembly language. And that's not a position I realize anyone held. But apparently, and it does talk about a little bit about this in the obituary, but there is a story that it does, you know, it does seem like it is a thing, that there was a time before there was assembly language. So she and her husband were working on the ARC, which was, what was it, the automatic relay calculator. And the code that they used, basically, I guess it's sort of like pre-processed code is, you know, essentially the beginning of assembly language. So
that's really cool. Yeah. I didn't know that had an inventor either.
No, but and now that I think about it, I guess somebody had to come up with it, but it never occurred to me to think about that.
Yeah, somebody had to be the first to come up with a set of mnemonics that translated one-to-one into machine code. Like, that's sort of the first logical step to abstract machine code into something that is, you know, you have some hope of writing as a human being.
Yeah.
That's really neat.
Okay, two more. So I don't know too much about it. But Lane Nooney has a book coming out, and it is coming out in May, and it is called The Apple II Age, How the Computer Became Personal. Do you guys know anything about this? I know there's an overview here.
Yes, and I'm a huge fan of her, and I became a fan of her because of Quinn's interview, basically, on another show, which introduced me to this wonderful, amazing, brilliant person, who I followed ever since.
I did not know she was writing this book, though. That's awesome.
And apparently it's still, you know, in the proof stage, you know, so it'll be a little while, but
May 8th, 2023. Okay.
Right. But 352 pages, it says, University.
Yeah, she's been talking about it on a bit on Twitter, sort of once in a while, and like when it hits different milestones and things. So I've been quite excited about it.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, talking about it on what?
Oh, yes, exactly. There used to be this thing called the internet, and a bunch of billionaires came and ruined everything.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, the quick backstory is that we interviewed her on Open Apple about various things, but the funnest part for me of the conversation was the talk about printer stands and how printer stands are the canonical example of furniture that had to be invented for personal computers, and also the conversation about where in your house the personal computer should go.
That was so fascinating. Because nobody knew.
It was an entirely new category of appliance that hadn't happened to households.
And that whole idea never occurred to me until that interview when she started talking about it. And I've never stopped thinking about it. This idea is like, where does it go? And how does it affect? Like, oh my goodness. It's just absolutely fascinating interview.
Yeah, my brain exploded when she said that, because it's like, oh, wow. Because then you think back at your own history and it's like, oh yeah, when we got our Apple II Plus, we put it in like 8 different places in the house because we didn't know where to put it either. Like, we had it by the TV for a while, but then you're in the way of the TV when you're using it. We had it at the back of the room, but that you can't see the TV. You got to turn around. So then we had it in the kitchen for a while, but it was in the way. So it was in the basement for a while, but then it was too hard to get down there and use it. And so, like most of us, it ended up in my bedroom. But we spent a long time literally moving it around the house, trying to figure out where to put this thing, and then buying weird like end tables and things to try and figure out what kind of furniture to put this thing on. Cause at the time, putting it on a desk didn't seem right. And desks were too high because they were made for writing. And so the height wasn't correct for typing. And there was no place to put the monitor. So you needed to, whole thing. It was fascinating.
Yeah. And so the story here, is, you know, it's about the Apple II and the, you know, its most compelling story, this, I'm reading the overview, its most compelling story isn't found in the feat of its engineering, the personalities of Apple's founders, or the way it set the stage for the you know, future. It's the what made the Apple II iconic was its software. In software, we discover the material reasons people bought computers, not to hack, but to play, not to code, but to calculate, not to program, but to print. Anyway, yes, I'm looking forward to seeing how that turns out, but I'm optimistic that it will be great.
This is exciting.
Yeah. Okay, last thing, which is, I guess we'll put a link to Lane's webpage as well. The last thing is, this was, Tony sent this over email, and it's getting teletext running on a BBC Micro. It's a video by Matthew North Music, and it's a pretty interesting sort of process. So he wanted to try to bring teletext back onto an actual BBC Micro, and so he did some experiments that were reading enough of a tape. So if we talked, I think, a little bit about how this worked, but there's like some sort of sub signal or super signal or side signal that carried the text, and it came in a stream. So there was, you could say, I want to look at page 240 or whatever, and it would just wait until he got to page 240 in the stream and then put that on the screen. And he had some, you know, old hardware that would do that, and spent a little while trying to fiddle with this device to try to get it from a recorded tape, you know, from the back in someday, you know, onto the screen. I don't know if he succeeded in that exactly, but he did connect up with a kind of like a modern recreation of this stream that would sort of take current news and package it up in the CFAX way to send it over teletext, and so he actually got it working, and he at the end of the video he's talking about how he didn't actually think this was going to work, and he's very pleased with it. And
I like this. I like combining multiple weird old technologies. Well, and we had some version of it in Canada as well at one point, because I remember hearing that it existed. We never owned a TV that supported it, but I remember hearing that it did exist. It didn't get nearly the use here that it did in, you know, places like France and Britain, but there was definitely like a stock ticker or whatever that you could get if your TV supported it.
Now, I guess we can move from the feedback to the very distinct items of interest in news, where Carrington will start us off.
Very, very distinct. So the first one I have is a neat thing showing it on screen, so it's not that interesting to look at since it's something on GitHub. So hey, look, it's GitHub. But the thing itself is kind of cool. So this is a Mastodon client. We've been talking about Twitter and its impending doom and the nonsense going on there. So a lot of people are jumping ship to other things, including Mastodon. And Mastodon has now come to the IBM PC. So a lot of people are running, you know, Mastodon clients on PCs. But this is for, you know, MS-DOS. So it's an MS-DOS client for Mastodon. It requires you to have either a virtual machine or original hardware with some sort of network connection. So you can go and do Mastodoning, or whatever the verb is going to be for Mastodon. What I found particularly interesting about this, like, this is cool. It's neat that there's a Mastodon thing. MS-DOS Mastodon client. That itself, neat, worth talking about. But the line that caught me was this. It's called Dostodon, because of course it is. Dostodon is implemented in JavaScript. So, wait, how is it in JavaScript? Yep, because it uses, turns out there's a JavaScript implementation for MS-DOS as well. There's a whole DOS JavaScript canvas that I didn't know existed. So if you want to write things for MS-DOS and you prefer to write them in JavaScript, turns out that's a thing. So that's a thing that already existed. Didn't know about that either. Two things became news to me. So if you have old 1980s DOS hardware, not only can you run Mastodon, you can also write things for it. It's got sound, it's got graphics, a whole bunch of stuff. There's a whole JavaScript canvas for DOS. Who knew?
So it's running the JavaScript engine on the DOS machine?
On MS-DOS. There's a whole JavaScript interpreter. It uses a whole bunch of things. But it's got sound, it's got PDFs, it's got... I don't know how this runs and how slowly this runs. But it's got a whole bunch of modules.
This isn't a DOS emulator that runs in a browser written in JavaScript?
No, this is JavaScript for MS-DOS, not the other way around.
I am shocked that that is
right?
possible.
How is that a thing? How is that a thing that exists?
Because JavaScript is a pig. Like, right? It needs 10 times as much power to put a pixel on the screen as anything yeah. else. So
I don't understand this. And I'm sure there's something going on here that I simply am not getting my head around, or I've got something wrong or whatever. But I kept thinking, well, this must be, you know, you use JavaScript to pretend to be DOS. No, you use JavaScript under DOS.
Yeah, it says runs in DOSBox and Unreal Hardware or on a virtual machine.
Unreal Hardware. That's something that gets me. So you can run this, and it's using that to create this, make the Mastodon client in JavaScript for this. So all
that's
of
amazing.
This was impressive to me. So.
Yeah. Huh. I wonder if it's just a small subset or if it compiles it in some way. Or
It's got to. It has to compile it in some way. There's got to be some sort of minified thing or something. Something. How can you even load it? Like, so anyway, the whole thing was cool. So this was news. Just found out about this. So if you are jumping to Mastodon, as lots of people are, hit me up on Old Bytes. That's where I am. It seems that's where I've landed. And if you're doing it on old hardware, then this seems like a cool way to go.
I wonder if we need a Mastodon instance for RCR, probably.
Oh, for RCR? Yeah, of course we do.
Yeah. Well, I'll get on that.
During all your free time.
I am not on Mastodon. I don't understand it, I'm afraid. As soon as I found out, the first question you have to ask is, which server should I join? I was like, oh, all right. I'm out.
I had a lot of trouble with it. Somebody finally explained to me in a way that I get it, that made it really obvious and easy for me. Think of it like email. Your email is hosted wherever. So you are Quinn at wherever. Same thing. You can get to everybody from everywhere. It's just like, who's your host?
I see.
Versus you're on Twitter. Makes... No, this is just, it's email. So I am at gmail.com. It doesn't matter where your host is. That's just where you are.
Okay.
And it's a little easier. You can always see a stream of the people who happen to be on the same server as you, but everybody can see everybody everywhere. It's just like email. So I'm like, okay. That's easier for me to get my head around.
That is helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the thing that kind of stopped me a little bit is that, you know, everybody, there are all these little servers, and there's always the chance, I guess this would actually be even worse with email, but there's always the chance that, like, the one you pick will cease to exist at some point.
Chance, I think, during a long enough time period.
That's right. Heat death of the universe, it will be gone.
Yeah. Well, that's why everyone jumped on Gmail, because it's like, here's finally an email address that I'm going to get to keep for a good 10 years or so. I think that was part of the appeal of Gmail. And maybe at some point, some Mastodon server will sort of become the de facto standard or something. It'll gel at some point.
All right. Let's see. I have the next thing.
Ooh, this one. Ooh, this item is controversial.
Oh, is it?
Ooh, I'm excited.
That's exciting.
Okay. The news coverage of it was poor, and a science podcast that I listened to had quite a bit to say about it.
Ah, okay. All right,
intrigued. So, I don't know. What are we talking about?
Well, it is a Nature article called Neurons in a Dish, Learn to Play Pong.
I've been called worse.
Yeah. So the story, here's a nice picture, though, of people playing Pong in the 70s. not unclear exactly how, you know, at least one of the players is actually succeeding at this while not looking at the screen, but I guess he is losing. So maybe that has something to do with why. What the story is that they took some, it's a proof of concept. Cortical Labs in Melbourne, Australia has taken some neurons, put them in a dish, sort of fed them with inputs that would correspond to seeing what's going on the Pong screen. So it allows the neurons to set the position of the paddle, and it lets it see the ball through, like, lighting up a kind of a sequence of neurons. And the point is essentially to create a little biological processing unit and cause it to play Pong. That's almost as much as I know, except that it ends saying, in the meantime, the decision to embody dish brain, as they call it, activity as the game Pong was a masterstroke. People interested in AI are very keen on anything that can play Pong.
I can't get past dish brain. New nickname. Can I change my name here in this thing? I want to change.
Good question.
Dish brain. Dish brain.
Yeah. All right. So what is the counter take?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it was a while ago that I heard this countertake, so what we can maybe do is link to the particular episode of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, where Dr. Stephen Novella talks about this article and how poor the reporting on it has been. So yeah, what you said is basically what all of the press is saying about it, and that's basically entirely wrong.
Awesome.
Yeah, what's happening is
first
really
of all, they're playing
pretty...
Quake.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. I was thinking that, you know, Doom seems to be the thing that you really want, right?
Yeah. Yeah, can a Petri dish run Doom? My understanding is that it's basically the same type of thing that neural networks have always been doing, which is that they can recognize a pattern of inputs and produce an output. And that's basically the end of it. There was a small tweak to the methodology and how they did that. And then somehow Pong got wrapped up into it. And then this whole metaphor got applied to it and the mainstream press ran away with it. And the whole story just got butchered. So, but yeah, the details are important here and I will butcher them myself if I attempt them. So instead we can link people to the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe where they clarified exactly what happened here.
Okay, cool. I mean, what you said sounds plausible. That this really is just like machine learning, except with biology.
I mean, it's the kind of experiment that has been done many, many, many times, and it's a nice application of a standard experiment that is done on neurons in a Petri dish. So it's not, there's no major ground being broken here. This is more of just a procedural thing that they did that was kind of interesting. But yeah, the reporting on it has unfortunately just been so poor that the plot is completely lost about what actually happened here.
Cool. All right.
It's one of those things where, like, every time there's a story about metamaterials, all of the press is like, invisibility cloak, and there's pictures of Harry Potter at the top of the article. But that's not at all what metamaterials are actually about. So, you know, things like that.
Excellent. October 12th, 2022. We'll link to the podcast episode that will tell us the truth.
Yeah, I'll dig it up, yeah.
Jeremy in the chat says the SGU is very good. I also recommend them for a check on this item.
So what I'm hearing is this thing can think.
Yeah, I think that's what we're hearing, yes.
That's
pretty much the truth.
It's become sentient and... Yeah.
And wants the vote.
That's right. It's going to buy Twitter next.
It would do a better job. I mean, hilarious. Neurons in a dish, run Twitter.
Right.
Stock price soars.
So anyway, we'll leave that. Maybe we'll come back to it next time. And now turn to more Commodore news.
Yeah, so I will share this item. I like that we have kind of a Commodore theme going. Commodore does not get enough love on this show, especially when Earl's not here.
Was like in quotes? Oh, no.
It was not. I'm Commodore open. Commodore curious.
You're Commodore curious.
So what I love about this story is that it's the kind of thing, I love it when people find a use case for retro computers that kind of makes sense in the modern world. Anytime you can identify a little task, like here is a thing that a modern computer does with 0.001% of its time, but would consume an entire retro computer, but it's a self-contained task, so let's give it to said retro computer. And ironically, tweeting is one of those things. You know, people are always getting retro computers to tweet because it's something that they can do. So this is using a Commodore 64 for two-factor authentication. Many of us who use banking apps or access to VPNs in offices and things will have, you know, the Google Authenticator app on your phone, and it has a little timer running, and every 10 seconds or so, a new six-digit code is displayed. So this is a very, very secure form of two-factor authentication. Vastly more secure, by the way, than texting. So don't use SMS for TFA if you can help it. If the service offers the Authenticator app, you always, always want to use this.
Which the only thing in my whole life that doesn't offer that is my bank.
Yes, right?
Yeah. Incredibly
so annoying. Yeah. So annoying.
The bank's also sending you all these. You're the one I really wanted to have. But thank goodness no one can get into my Steam account.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it that the banks also always send you like emails that say, click on this link to see your statement.
We dare you. We just want to train you to always click on links from us.
Yeah, exactly. It's terrible.
Worst capture ever.
Yeah. And if anyone's wondering, the reason you want to use SMS for TFA is because SMS is very easily spoofed. So it's trivial to clone your phone number and thus intercept your TFAs. So more to the point, though. So this person has written a TFA authenticator app for the Commodore 64. And appropriately enough, it's on the SS64, so you can bring it with you with your on the road with your phone app or whatever. But what I love about this story even more than this, though, and the reason that it really caught my eye, is that the hard part of this is not what I expected it to be. Obviously, there's some cryptography involved in a TFA app, so I assumed doing the crypto math was going to be the hard part. It's not. The hard part is the timer. And the reason that it's hard is because obviously the time is factored into the math for calculating the code, and that's the whole point, is that it's a rolling code. So every, I think it's 10 seconds, it generates a new code. The problem is the rolling time code that's needed for this algorithm is done with Unix time, so number of seconds since 1970. Now, most 8-bit computers and 16-bit computers had clock chips that you could get for them. Those clock chips did not use Unix time. Those clock chips gave you time in a human-readable format because that's the application that you were using it for. So you put a clock chip in your Apple II, you want the date and the year and the month and so on, because it's going to get displayed in ProDOS or it's going to get displayed in your word processor or whatever in that format. And that's good because you don't want to use a bunch of CPU time to be constantly converting from seconds into a human-readable date format. Anyone who's written date code on a modern application knows it's actually a pretty terrible thing to try and calculate what the actual day of the week is from, you know, seconds since 1970. It's a pretty terrible calculation. You got to account for leap years and daylight savings time and all this madness. It's difficult. So the clock chips back in the day just gave you the time in a human readable format straight out of the hardware. But what that means is that this TFA app, which requires Unix time, has to convert back from a human readable date, modern date format, to seconds since 1970. So that turned out to be extremely difficult and time consuming, and that's the hard part of this. So I thought that whole story was really, really interesting because of that. And it makes you appreciate what we have today with basically infinite software horsepower to do this kind of stuff. The fact that it requires most of a retro computer's power just to convert a date back into seconds is food for thought. So I thought this was really neat, and he does get it to work, and so he can actually log into his bank with his Commodore SX64.
Excellent. So he can go to Starbucks with his iPad, sign into his bank over the insecure Wi-Fi.
Exactly. Yes. As long as he's sitting close to a power outlet. Yeah.
Yeah. Right, and Carrington, you have the next thing.
Oh, Sprocket has made an appearance.
Hello, Sprocket.
Yes, me next. Call me Dishbrain. So, this is really fun. If you're a fan of old computers, you'll of course remember the turbo button. You had your 486, you got that turbo button in the front. Well, somebody, Matthew Frost is this somebody's name, has created a turbo button for modern PCs. And it's so much cooler than you'd even think, because it actually does work. Well, work in quotes, like Commodore 64s. So this fits in a 5.25-inch slot on a modern tower or mini tower. And as you can see from the photo now displayed on StreamYard, if you're watching live, it has both a 3-digit 7-segment display, 2 buttons, and a key lock, all of which are functional, all of which are cool. So how this works is with the power profile on Windows, which doesn't make a massive difference, but especially on a desktop where you don't really care about saving clock cycles to make your battery last longer. But when you press the button, it uses a little microcomputer. So basically got an Arduino type thing, I think. I don't remember which one he's using, but something like that. It's inside this, and it switches your power profile on the PC to go, and you can call it turbo, and to go from your, you know, battery savings, so I'm only going to be at 3.5 gigahertz, up to your max it out at 4 gigahertz or whatever, I don't care about my battery, again, on your desktop. So the turbo button, when you press it, does switch your profile, and the display is the actual CPU's megahertz. It keeps polling it, and it actually shows you what your current megahertz are. You press the button, and then suddenly see it jump up to like 3.8 gigahertz or whatever. Like, it's delightful. The button beside it, the next button, switches what this does. So they'll show you in percentages your percentage of GPU use, your percentage of RAM that's being used, something like this, a few different things, which is just, again, delightful. And the percentage of like your network traffic in megabytes or something like that. But then the key lock is extra fun. What it does when you turn it disables whatever your chosen network card is. So you basically do the key, boom, you're off the net. Instantly disables the net. So he uses it to let his kids play on the computer but not get internet access. You can literally physically lock it. And it's all just delightful. It's like, it's such a great throwback to the old turbo buttons, which were themselves kind of equally useless. Yeah. And so I love it. I think it blends in so nicely to the computer. There is a video on the site. So we're going to have a link to his site. It's on Hackster.io. But there's a link to a video from that, a YouTube video, that goes through all of this, shows you how it's made, how it works. And it's absolutely fantastic. I think, a great implementation of this. So if you have longed for a turbo button, he's got a link to how the faceplate was made, where the buttons were purchased from, the Arduino, whatever the equivalent was he's using, the wiring, everything. Like, it's just like, here's everything you used, including the scripts you can download to run it. So if you want to implement it yourself, looks fairly straightforward. You just need a PC with a 5 1/4 inch available slot, and you can go to town. I love it. Totally love it. I want it.
Yeah. It is delightful.
Yeah. It is cool.
So the turbo button is misunderstood, and I only recently learned this myself, that the reason it's so misunderstood is because they named it turbo. Really, what they should have named it is like the slowdown button, because its purpose was to run older, particularly PC games that used...
That's what I assumed it was for. Right?
Yeah, that used cycle counting for timing instead of vertical blank.
And well, so you want to drop back down to 66 megahertz or whatever, because I was like, why would you ever turn it off other than for games?
Uh-huh. Yeah, there was apparently a few games that did not use the vertical blank for timing, mostly really old games. So for those games would not run properly with the new higher clock speeds. Because I guess the PC AT had a standardized, the XT and AT had standard clock speeds or whatever, so the games could rely on that. But then as newer CPUs came out, they were all running at different clock speeds. And so that's hence the turbo button. The point of it was to be able to turn it off and have your machine run back at the old official AT or XT clock speed.
I can see in the Apple II world, I've encountered that with, you know, do virtual II stuff, and certain games you cannot play unless it's
load runner, you
know, pretending to be just 1 megahertz.
Yeah, it's more like the ability to turn off your transwarp or your, you know, 2C+ accelerator so that games will work. It's the same thing, but they didn't call it the backward compatibility button. They called it the turbo button, and so that it became a running joke, because why would you not want that? Yeah. So anyway, I thought that was a neat little thing.
Yeah, I was in fact going to ask that very question. I didn't understand why there was a turbo button, and now I do.
Yeah, because they named it turbo, I think it got this reputation as a marketing gimmick, like a button that makes your computer faster, but of course you would leave it turned on. But yeah, I think it got a bad reputation because of that. And it would, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, turbo was such a hip word. Like, everything was turbo. Like, you could get sunglasses that said turbo on them for no reason. And it was a hip word. So that was a lot of it too, I think.
Nothing wrong with being hip. Someday I hope to achieve that myself.
Yeah.
I'm working on it.
Keep working.
I'm working slowly. I need my turbo glasses.
That's right.
Then my dad's going to buy this mountain and close it down.
All right, let's see. So I have, next thing here is Angry Birds for the Apple II. This is, I think, so I'm not quite exactly sure what the status of this is. I think people have actually started receiving it, in fact. So I thought it was still just being beta tested. But at any rate, this is Mark Golenbeck. And on, there's a Facebook group called Call-151 that on which a lot of the development information is being posted, so you can sort of see how this was progressing. But it is, you know, it's the kind of thing that you could do on an old, you know, Apple type computer. It's not a very sophisticated game, but it looks great. Actually, the music sounds fantastic because it's going through a Mockingboard, that's one of, you know, when I played a little demo of it.
Do you mean Mockingbird?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But groan. Yeah. I guess that one was hanging out there. Someone had to take a swing at it.
That's right. I'm not sure that advanced you toward hipness, but
I'm never sure what's going to advance me towards hipness.
Yeah.
Just throw everything out there.
But anyway, so this is I think it's double high res, and it's
double low res.
Double low res. That's what I meant. Yes, in my head I had that right. Yes, it's definitely
it's
nothing
res
like high res. Yeah, But it looks great. And I'm kind of looking forward to playing it. Although, I didn't quite get into the Angry Birds craze. You know, I played it a little bit, and then somehow it stops being interesting. But maybe in this incarnation it will be more interesting, just because it's running on Roto hardware.
I'll be curious to see how he does the physics, because that was the killer feature of Angry Birds. The reason it was so interesting is because the structures that you're shooting the birds at had a real 2D physics simulation on them, so they collapsed and fell apart in really interesting ways. And they had a lot of the puzzles were based around the physics of how things were going to fall, and that was fairly novel at the time to do that. So with that would be very difficult to do on an Apple II. Like, the horsepower required for a proper physics simulation is not there. So you'll have to fake that in some interesting way, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Maybe it's available in JavaScript for MS-DOS. That apparently can do everything.
Perhaps. Apparently. Yeah. Anyway, so there's a little write-up on Vintage is the New Old, and again, a lot of this stuff is happening on the Facebook group. It's not yet on his own webpage. There is an Apple II section, and I would have expected it to be here somewhere. This is the same person who is responsible for Dolores, the Dolores graphics library, and so forth. I mean, like, yeah, it's so it's not coming from a surprising place, I guess, in a sense. But it doesn't seem like it has an official web presence yet. Maybe it soon will.
Looks really cool, though. It looks really well done.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. That was all I had. Quinn, you have the next thing.
Yeah, so we had a bit of a Commodore 64 theme, and we also have a bit of a PC theme going today, which is nice, because I think early PC stuff doesn't get quite enough love here on the show either. So this is being shared not just for the amazing triple stack of cards on display in this image, but what this is doing is this is an emulator board for ISA cards on early PCs. So if you want to play, you know, classic Golden Age MS-DOS games, you need a bunch of ISA cards, right? You need your Sound Blaster, and you need your VGA board, and you need all these different things. You need your game port, and maybe you need a Novell networking card to play your networked games or whatever, right? So all of these ISA boards that don't exist anymore and are not necessarily maybe easy to find. So if you want to run DOS games on real hardware, you might be stuck trying to find all these old boards in order to get the experience that you had. It's not like running old Amiga games where all the hardware is right there already. With old PC games, you have to get all of the hardware that everybody had. So that's what this is solving. And what it is, it's an FPGA that interfaces to a Raspberry Pi. And so the FPGA is handling the ISA traffic for you at the proper speeds, because that would be difficult to do in software. And so it's handling that. And then software running on the Raspberry Pi can then emulate just about any ISA board. So they have a software core that emulates a Sound Blaster or, you know, a game port or a Novell card or whatever. And then the FPGA does the ISA part of it, which, again, the trying to bit bang an ISA protocol fast enough on a Raspberry Pi would be pretty impossible. So that's what the FPGA is doing for you. And
well, that's very cool.
It's very cool. It's very clever. It's solving a problem I would not have thought of, because I'm not like a hardcore, you know, bare metal DOS gamer. But if you want to play, like on the example shown here, if you want to play Space Quest on an original 386, you're going to have to go dig up all of the cards that would have been in, you know, a high-end 386 at that time to get the full experience. And so this basically solves that problem for you. And it's clever. I really like it. Like, he's showing it here running, emulating a DOS mouse and a Roland MT32 soundboard, which, you know, is pretty exotic hardware that would be hard to find now, but is certainly the best experience for playing Space Quest 3 or 4, as he's showing here. So I love this. You know, real hardware DOS gaming doesn't get as much love, I think, because DOS games are a lot easier to emulate on modern PCs, so that's what people tend to do. But you know, there's nothing like real hardware, and so if you want to do it,
and that's the thing with a modern emulator, you can just pick, okay, what cards are in it or whatever, and this gives you that ability, but in real hardware. That's amazing.
Exactly. Yeah, you can fire it virtual too and be like, oh well, I have a mouse card in slot 4 and it'll just emulate that. But yeah, you can't do that on real hardware, obviously. And it's not like, again, like on an Apple II, nobody assumed you had any carts. All of the games ran on bare hardware because that's all most people had. PC games are different. Those DOS games, they assumed all kinds of hardware. They assumed everybody had a Sound Blaster. They assumed everybody had a game port and everybody had a mouse card and everybody had VGA or Super VGA. So yeah, if you want to go buy, if you go buy an old PC on eBay, it's going to come out of some bank or something, and who knows what cards are in it. Probably nothing. It's probably got Hercules graphics and nothing else in it or something. So now you got to go and on a quest, if you will, to find all of these cards so that you can play Space Quest. So this is, yeah, a really great solution to a real problem, and I love it.
So one thing you were saying that like you need to collect the cards together to do this, like people assumed you had several cards, and so the first thing I thought is, okay, well, so do I have to get like three of these and plug them in? But then is it possible for? I know that on the Apple II, at least I don't think it actually matters what slot things are in. They can just say like, I live in this space, I live in this space, and I respond to these addresses. And I'm wondering if the PC can do a similar thing where you just say, I'm going to plug it into, you know, the second slot, but it's going to respond as if I have cards in the first three.
Yeah, so the PC cards were all interrupt driven. So all that mattered was what the IRQ settings on the card were, and that the software was looking for the card in this on the same interrupt ID. So it didn't matter I don't believe it ever mattered where the cards were physically located in the machine. Mm-hmm. It only mattered what the IRQ setting was. So the card would have a jumper block on it to set it, you know, the sound card is on IRQ3, and then you'd have to set that same thing in the software. And sometimes games would assume an IRQ, and sometimes different cards would require an IRQ, and sometimes those IRQs would conflict. So you'd have, you know, a game port and a sound card that both wanted IRQ 3, and so they needed to figure out how to work around that and so on. So that was kind of the quote-unquote fun of early DOS gaming. But my understanding is that this thing just takes up one ISA slot and can emulate multiple cards, because, again, it's just... Once you've got something on the ISA bus, it doesn't care where anything physically is. It's just sending the traffic out onto the bus. So as long as you've got the right software to physically fake or to virtually fake and respond to the IRQs that are supposed to be set, then it should just work. I think that's what this is doing.
That's cool. That's very cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah, it's almost somewhere between hardware and software emulation, because it's just occupying a single slot, but virtually emulating all of the slots, and the cards are emulated in software, but the interface is in hardware. So yeah, it's neat. It's a little bit mind bending what he's doing here.
Yeah. I approve. Thumbs up from me.
So little PC love on the channel. Don't get enough of that.
All right. Let's see. I think we are now at the point where we can go. Is that correct? Are we already at the point, word from our sponsor? I think we are. So now, a word from our sponsor.
Yesterday all I felt was tired, but suddenly I'm re-inspired. I'm making music on my PC. It's really simple with 1, 2, 3. I'm learning how to use its power and speed. I finally found myself the disc I need. Baby, I'm becoming a PC whiz, 'cause now I know with Lotus how easy it is.
They're working with their PCs, I'm happy as I can be. They're working with Lotus 1, 2, 3. Yeah, Lotus 1, 2, 3. Lotus 1, 2, 3.
You'll never finish by morning.
No problem. Now, command the powers of Atom with professional keyboard, high-speed memory drive, and built-in word processor program, all in one package.
Oops, you gotta start over.
Relax, Atom. We've got paragraph.
Is that legal?
And print.
Atom, even a letter-quality daisy wheel printer.
Atom, my launch sequence.
Is that legal?
Command the powers of Atom and program your future.
And we're back. Okay, so the host's retro computing gift idea this time, I think this is interesting. We'll see. It is the HDD clicker. So we've seen similar things like this, I think, for floppy drives. But it's basically just like a little noisemaker you can put on your flash memory based hard drive emulator. So if you feel like, you know, your computer is too quiet, and you liked the little seek noises that the hard drive made, you can get one of these things and plug it in, and it will click along with the accesses to the drive. And there is actually a sort of a use case for this, which is that it tells you whether your computer has hung.
Yes, absolutely. This is a real problem. We've talked about this before, I'm sure, but in emulators, that drives me crazy because old software assumed that, right? So when you're running, you're booting something up in, or you're loading a new screen, let's say on something in Virtual 2, the software assumed that the drive noises were there and thus didn't need to display anything indicating it was busy. So when you run these things in emulators now, all of a sudden you get like 5 second black screens and stuff, and you're just like, what is happening? And it's without the floppy drive noises to indicate that the machine is still busy, it's doing stuff. You don't know. It's really quite a different experience.
So it's not exactly simulating the seeking. So I mean, the idea is that it's going to simulate the seeking of the heads back and forth. But what it really is doing is it just plugs into the activity light. So whenever the light goes on, it clicks, and that's close enough. I mean, it does allow for a certain amount of noise.
It's a good idea.
Yeah, I don't think I doubt I would detect the difference. You know, so on the screen there's a video of a defragmenting program running, which is of course quite noisy, but it does demonstrate it fairly well. You can buy this at Serta Shop. And there, I think that, if I'm not mistaken, the design is open source, so the Serta Shop is just making them. You could make them yourself if you wish. But if you wanted to get one pre-made, it is £25. They are in stock. You can choose your options. There is a little case that you can get it in. And I think you can also get it with a sticker on the speaker or not on the speaker, depending on how old of a machine you want it to sound like.
That's great.
That is very good.
Those early PC hard drives were loud. Holy cow.
Yeah.
That's great. So, yeah. This is a good idea. I like it because, again, if you were like a PC gamer that wanted to play on real hardware, like that's a big part of the experience was those hard drive noises, you know, the hard drive clicking away. Again, especially the older machines. Like I remember the machines we used in high school, we had an Olivetti lab, and we had some older machines, some XTs that had these 5 megabyte drives in the music room. And I mean, those things sounded like someone was like banging on the door, you know, when they were running. Like,
maybe I want to play.
Yeah, they were loud. And that was certainly a big part of the experience of using those machines, is that constant banging and rattling coming from the hard drives.
And not too expensive. I mean, you know, it's a little bit, it seems a little trivial, but I think it probably would really actually add to the experience. So, all right. And once you're done, you know, making your hard drives loud again, you can head over to eBay, and Carrington has the first things that he will try to sell me on.
I does have a thing. I'm gonna sell you some stuff, Paul. It's time to sell Paul things. The first thing I'm gonna sell you is a set of dice. It's 3 dice, but they're binary dice. I don't know if these were for a particular game or just like learn binary stuff, but there's binary dice from Creative Computing. So they're dice, six-sided, but they only have ones and zeros on them. And then there's a little chart that comes with them to tell you which thing is in which position and how to read them. I think this would be like a fun way to teach somebody binary, like just how to read binary, throw the dice, and as like a flashcard system for binary, essentially. But I don't know if they were for a game. Like, why did they come as dice? It seems weird, but Creative Computing sold sets of dice that are just binary. So, world's worst D&D character or something. Attack you for a total of 3.
Critical fail.
So, I don't know. They kind of caught my eye because it's dice, red, a green, and a blue. And they're ones and zeros. That's what it is. And the person is selling a bunch. You can buy them. You can get one set for $25, or you can buy two or more. They've got 4 left, but I think it's a relisting, and they originally had a bunch. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a whole bunch of these things available. But for $25, Paul, you can have a lot of Critical Failures.
I wonder, actually, now that you're saying that, I wonder if I do have them.
that as already sold it to you then.
I've seen this listing before. And now that I'm looking at it, it occurs to me that, like, you could simulate this equally well with three coins.
It's true, right?
But
okay, so this is a vintage item. Okay, I wasn't clear on that. This is not a new thing that someone has made. This was something that Creative Computing made back in the day.
Back in the day, right, yes.
So that's neat.
For whatever reason. And you could back then get them for $1.25. So they were a great investment for this person who's now selling them for $25.
Yeah.
That's great. In our computer science undergrad lounge in university, we all played Magic the Gathering, which had just come out at the time, and it was a really big deal. And we used binary to track our life. Because they give you 20 of these, little glass beads to count your life. But you can, of course, just use 5 of them if you count in binary by sliding them up and down on the desk. So we used to do that because we were giant nerds.
Bunch of nerds.
Pretty proud of ourselves that we could do that.
So anyway, that's my first thing. My first thing that I'm going to attempt to sell Paul. Paul's already bought them. That counts as a win for me.
Yeah. I can't remember, but I definitely have seen these before and have investigated whether you can, because it seems like the kind of thing you could. Oh, I wonder if it was like for, I feel like it was maybe for a Kansas Fest swag or something like that. There was some, I feel like I was looking to see if you could buy new ones.
Okay.
Of these.
Well, you can.
But yeah.
new old ones. Yeah. And the other thing I have is a rare, genuine, I want to come back to that word, Macintosh Extended Keyboard 2 carry bag. Why you would need a separate bag for carrying your keyboard, I don't know. But this is a bag specifically for the Macintosh Extended Keyboard 2, which was a good keyboard. I like the extended keyboard.
Everybody really likes that keyboard. That was it's a very popular
one. I don't think this is an Apple product. I don't think Apple would have put their logo askew the way this is. It's the top left corner. It looks all jaunty because it's on a 45-degree, and a lot of designs would put it up there. But Apple does not rotate their logo. Like, I think ever on any product ever. So I say this is not.
So. And it's placed incorrectly as well. Like, it's not centered in the corner, which, again, Apple would never get that wrong.
So it's listed as a genuine thing. And I'm sure it's genuinely a bag, but I don't believe it's a genuine Apple product.
Yeah, I wondered. But I also came across this, and I was surprised at the existence of a bag specific to the keyboard.
Now, I haven't seen this before. Yeah. Like, so it's, I agree, relatively rare, but it could be, like, a person made one.
Yeah. It's from Australia. Maybe it was from the Australian market. I don't know.
Maybe that's not askew in Australia.
That's right.
Maybe Michael here tell us.
Maybe it's actually the bag that's askew.
Yeah, it's because the bag is in Australia. So.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Logos rotate the opposite direction in that hemisphere. So who knows what's going on?
It's the Logiolus effect.
Oh, God. So it's a genuine bag. This I agree with, but it's also odd to have a carry case just for the keyboard. Like, how often do we carry? Oh, let me bag up my computer. Let me separately bag up my keyboard.
But they are big, and so I have one here on the screen. They are big, and they're bigger. If you have
bigger in a bag, though, the bag doesn't make as much. It's not a Doctor Who bag. It's not a genuine Who.
Yeah,
thing.
Or Mary Poppins or whatever. Yeah,
right.
But I think it's for the SE30, I have a bag. Because I'm a fancy person that has an SE30. But
you're fancy person for having an SE30 to start with.
Yeah, but the keyboard sticks up too high. I mean, like, it's too long for that bag, so it doesn't zip properly when you have this keyboard in it. So I could see, it's everybody loves the keyboard, but it's just a little too big, and so I could see maybe wanting to carry it separately and not have it like bang around in your car or whatever.
But it's a desktop keyboard for a desktop computer. How much are you carrying this thing around anyway? But anyway, this was my second choice because it was interesting. I hadn't seen it before. It's relatively expensive, $100 Australian. So that says it's $66 approximately US. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a genuine Apple product, but it's got a logo on it.
Yeah, I would be interested if anybody has seen one.
Maybe it's rare because they got sued for that terrible rendition of their
logo. It's a Steve Jobs rejection. It was a prototype. Yeah. Now it's even more expensive.
Yeah. Well, and the stripes aren't the right size. Like, the purple stripe is thinner for some reason. Is that just the photo? Or is it?
I don't know. That's a good question.
It might be just the photo or real life, or who knows.
Yeah. It might be just because of that fold is in an awkward place there. Maybe it's at a weird angle.
And I get that the colors on something that's like embroidered like this are never going to bang on match, especially back then.
Not the
Pantone
tones.
Was difficult. Pantone's still difficult. Just saying. So these colors don't, but I don't really ding it for the colors, but I ding it for like the shape of the bite looks wrong. And mostly I ding it for the fact that it's on a 45 degree. That seems, that's a big red flag for me.
Well, and the stitching is not great, right? Like the yellow stripe doesn't line up with the other stripes. It stops short. Like the quality is not where an Apple embroidered bag would be for sure. You can, if you look closely at the yellow stripe, it stops short. I suppose that could be where maybe those threads fell out or something, but it just looks a little bit shoddy.
Yeah.
Or it could have been in those years, you know, between Steve.
Maybe this was considered great work for Australia. Michael's not here, so I can see what I want.
That's right.
Yeah, this could have been a John Scully or who was the other guy that lasted like 3 weeks?
Gil Emilio or whatever?
Yeah, Emilio. That's right, Gil Emilio. This might have been a him thing.
It could be. For John Scully, there'd be 15 versions of this bag, all of which were slightly different names.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Jeremy in the chat says, I have ones and zeros for birthday candles, and we celebrate people's ages in binary.
All candles look like ones.
Yeah,
like
as long as you have 5 ones and 5 zeros, you're good for most ages.
Or you could just do candle, no candle.
That's right.
You just have to regularly space the candles. You might need a parody candle at the end because it could be a little confusing.
Got a parody candle.
Maybe a start candle and a stop candle. I don't know. You might have to organize them in nibbles, though, because you can't have too many empty candles in a row or you won't be able to tell if it's zero. So, yeah, it's going to have to be nibble candles, I guess.
Yes.
We'll work on it.
All right. Let's see. Am I next? I think I'm next. All right, I have a set of things that are randomly collected, as always. The first thing, I picked it, and it...
Have you already bought it? Did you sell it to yourself?
Unfortunately, it sold in the time. The auction title is, "What is it?" ? Condition is used. and it is this...
Somebody works in SEO.
Yeah. So it's a little board. It's got... three groups of two seven segment displays. In the picture, it says 0000C6. It has a little keypad that has hexadecimal, but then some other stuff, you know, RSGPWI. So not a full, you know, not a full alphabet, but some stuff. And it's a little thing in a box. The person said, what did they say? Up for auction is something I purchased at an estate sale, but I'm not really sure what it is. I tried to research it, but was not able to find any writing anywhere, so I didn't get far. what it is a cosmetic super elf. And it sold. probably because of that. I'm not sure. It says it was ended by the seller because there was an error in the listing. I actually didn't...
ended by the seller because they found out what it was. And what
yeah, they
found
they okay, they yeah. did. Okay, that's good. So now it's starting at 100 instead of starting at 50, and it says Quest Super Elf Trainer Board Rev 20 No Reserve. So, which I feel slightly better about because I think this is a somewhat desirable object, and so, you know, I would just as soon not have somebody like sneak away with it.
Sure.
But I did kind of like the auction title. What is it?
It's always a missed opportunity when people have the displays like that, the segmented displays, and they don't spell out like boobies or whatever. If I was doing listing, we all learned those little dirty words on calculators. I'm like, how don't you just put like, it's only got 6, so you put like S8008. Come on. Have some fun with your auction. I would.
I suspect actually it might be... could be that it's actually a little bit hard to populate those. I mean, like, you might have to know kind of what you're doing in order to get numbers into the leftmost display and stuff, because I think they're not...
As a kid in high school, I would have put that effort in.
Yeah. Okay. Definitely.
Yeah, you might actually have to write some code. Like, if that's displaying register contents or something, you'd actually have to write a little bit of code to fill them in to show what you wanted.
I feel a Hackfest entry coming on.
Yeah, it seems like it seems like kind of a fun thing to play with, but it's so it's got one of those 1802 chips in it, and And actually, so most of the examples I've seen online don't have all six of those seven-segment displays. They only have the rightmost one. So I don't actually know. There's something that's kind of not fully necessary about the other ones, I guess, if you can remember like what you typed in about the address you're putting something in or whatever.
It's in good shape. Like the keyboard looks really nice on it, which I imagine that they often don't. Like you can imagine those keys get broken off easily or lost. And yeah, it's in really good condition.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, even at 100, it's probably not, it's, you know, not unreasonable. So,
it's interesting that it comes in a giant box, which is empty. Like that wooden case is the one shot that shows the back of it, and it's just empty underneath. I don't understand why that is built that way.
I think the box is user added.
Oh, okay. I see.
So it's just take it up off the desk. So I don't know why. Yeah. So you don't spill coffee on it. I'm not sure exactly why you would do that, but
that almost looks like a drawer. Actually, someone found a drawer that just happened to be the exact right size, and so they slid the PCB in there.
Could be. Yeah. Okay. Sorcerer Stan says somewhat desirable is an understatement. I sold an Elf variant, Netronics Elf 2, recently, and it went for $1,000. This should go up for at least $500.
Oh wow! So it's still a steal at 100 then.
Yeah. So excellent. Hopefully somebody gets it who will appreciate it and knows what it is. All right. Let's see what else. I don't know why I put this up. This is a Decimal Skills Milton Bradley software. I think actually I put this up because I have it sitting over here and it seemed ridiculous that it was being sold for $200. I guess the complaint I have really is that this is not, it's not worth $200. It's the only reason that it's being listed for this is that there are people who are trying desperately to archive everything, and this is gouging those people.
I don't understand what it is though.
That's you know, skills. School software.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Milton Bradley, I guess. Okay.
Yeah. And here's that setup too with the security monitor and
the famous Apple II setup. Yeah. So this is presumably like converting fractions and other like grade school math types of things related to decimals. Oh yeah, division, mixed numbers,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, okay.
Be funny if it only worked on integer basic.
Right. It's in good shape and all, but actually this thing comes with, so you can see little bits of a book in here. Maybe I can grab it at some point, but it comes with like stuff that you're, as a teacher, allowed to photocopy. I mean, like you have sort of explicit permission to run this through your copier. But it actually makes it a little bit hard to scan because, I mean, like I have to try to decide, do I tear the thing apart like it's supposed to be so I can scan it? Does anyone care? Is it better if it's intact and just photographed? I don't know. Anyway, but it's a little annoying that stuff like this is listed for so much because the only reason somebody would ever buy this is because they just wanted to preserve everything. So they, you know, like there's no ignoble goal to buying this.
Presumably the person selling it just thinks it's rare and therefore valuable.
Yeah. Well, it could be. I mean, I guess that's slightly more noble than just saying I've noticed that people are buying up all the educational software, so I will price mine super high.
Ah, yeah, okay. If they looked at saved listings for this, prices are going up because of people trying to preserve it. That makes sense.
Yeah,
that is annoying.
But don't buy this one because I have one. and it didn't. I don't remember like where or when I got it, but it wasn't $200.
Right.
This one I thought was kind of interesting. This is a collection of Newton apps. So Quinn, you struggled along with the Newton for a while, right?
I did. I had the original Newton.
The year of the Newton. Desperate to take her notes. She'll prove everyone wrong.
That's right. Carried that thing around in my ski jacket pocket. Yeah. Terrible. This is an amazing set of software, though. I've never seen this much Newton software in one place.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing that kind of struck me about it is that, I'm sort of vaguely Newton aware, but it's still like I don't think of Newton as coming with like software on disks, but it very much did. You know, it didn't have a disk drive. You had to connect it to your, you know, either your Mac or your PC. So there's a Windows version of these disks and a Mac version of these disks. But there's also, you know, some charting programs. And I think one of the things that I thought was most interesting, I probably talked about this before, is Graffiti. Graffiti was a Newton app. It was the thing that was built into Palm, but you could use it on the Newton too.
Yeah, it was slightly controversial on the Newton because, of course, Graffiti's whole shtick is that you drew those special strokes in a small area at the bottom of the screen, and people felt that it was going to wear out that square inch of your Newton screen. Mm-hmm. And so there was like pro and anti Graffiti camps on the Newton, people saying, also, I think it was just mostly wrapped up in pro and anti Palm sentiment. Like the Newton diehards didn't like Palm because it was winning and they wanted to rail against anything related to Palm, and thus Graffiti was considered bad for your Newton screen and you shouldn't use it, blah, blah, blah. But I used it and it was great because the Newton handwriting recognition was terrible.
Right. Yeah. And it didn't take very long on the Palm to adjust. I mean, like you just knew how to
do it. Got used to it pretty quickly. Yeah. Yeah. And it did work so much better than the Newton one did. This is another case though, of I'm kind of amused to see all this packaging because Newton piracy was universal. Like I was not aware of anyone who bought anything on it. There was no copy protection as far as I know. So you just went on to the Newton newsgroup and all of the available software was there. So you just downloaded it and then sideloaded it onto your Newton and that was it. So I think I had most of these, but I certainly did not buy any of them.
Excellent. Yeah. Newt case. Who knows what that is?
I did not have. I don't know what this is.
I also do not know. Availworks. Now Synchronize.
That I had. I had the Now Synchronize, and I had Graffiti. I had the Utilities one that was there. Mm. I think I had this, Plus. I recognize that expenses one. I didn't use it because I'm not a business person, but I had it because I downloaded all the Newton stuff I could find because why wouldn't you?
Yeah. Anyway, interesting. It's pricey, but you can make an offer. It's $125 is what they're asking for this set of, I don't know what it is. It's the official Newton software, and then it's 8-ish apps. So...
which I think is all of them.
Yeah, right.
There was very little commercially produced Newton software. That might literally be all of it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of it. I have a little pile of Newton software that I got in modern days, and I don't know for sure if there's anything in here that isn't in that. I don't know if I have something that's different from this. So.
I wonder, there might be a case to be made that piracy literally did kill that software market. People always say that's happening, but it's never true. But in this case, it might be because there was no copy protection of any sort, because the software was all like written in a high-level language that just sat on top of. So the software was just, it was interpreted script. So there wasn't really any way to protect it. And so piracy was literally universal. And then the market being so small and so extremely technical that everybody who had a Newton was on Usenet, there was no casual market for those devices. So that all of that together meant, I think, selling software was probably just about impossible on that platform.
Was the Newton connected? It wasn't, was it? I mean, like, so I was thinking that, like, I had a Palm 7 that had that connected to PalmNet, but the Newton was isolated, wasn't it?
The initial one was not. So initially, the only way to get software on it was to sideload it with a cable. But then you could also, it had a slot. So I actually had a modem for mine. One of those, it had a PCMCIA slot in it. And so I had a really cool little modem with a flat RJ11 jack that popped out of it. Mm. And you could plug in a phone cord and dial up BBSs and stuff that way. And then later there was some sort of connectivity. I don't remember if there was ever like a Newton net or any kind of central service the way that Palm had, but you could use it as a terminal a little bit. For example, you could dial into servers and use your terminal on the Newton, things like that. And it was possible to transfer files back and forth over the network as well, but not until later.
Yeah, part of what I was thinking was that like that's going to be the place where you could imagine charging people that piracy won't help.
Yeah, and that Newton never really leaned into that very hard. It never made networking connectivity a first class citizen in the system, in the ecosystem, and that's really where Palm and BlackBerry, I think, did it better. And that's, I think, a large part of why they succeeded, not just because the devices were better, but also because of that they realized that connectivity was the thing that was going to make it a good idea, that was going to make it. Useful and helpful. So yeah, Newton was a little bit of an island. You had this cool device that did a lot of neat things, but it was hard to get data in and out of it.
Yeah. and you can't look at it without seeing yourself. Yeah. Very, very reflective device.
It was, yes.
Okay, let's see. What is this? Oh, yeah. I thought this was, you know, whatever. An interesting old Apple II. So this is it is an Apple II that is old enough. So its serial number on the case is A2S10217. So that's, you know, first 217th, I guess. It's old enough that it has no
vents.
Vents. Yeah, so...
Oh, that's super old. Look at that.
Yeah.
Because Steve Jobs said, by my will alone, there'll be no overheating.
That's right. And what's funny about these is that they also... I don't know if there's a better... Yeah, you can kind of see the
painted case, right?
The case, they always seem like they're made of Play-Doh or whatever, yeah. You know, clay or something. They're all kind of bent.
Wow, that's super old school, though.
Well, because the early cases were painted, right? They weren't colored plastic. They actually painted them.
Yeah. But, I mean, look, if you look at the hole here by the power supply, it's all ragged. And so the internals of it are not, that's all newer than the case. I mean, so this is it's a late 2 Plus motherboard and a replacement power supply and stuff.
That's
and I think
too bad.
Even the keyboard is replaced. But still, the you know, having a ventless case itself is pretty amazing.
That is cool.
So, and it is currently at, it has 7 days to go. So, I mean, it's still a long ways to go and it's already at $1,675.
It's going to go for real money. I could see someone having an early Apple II, Rev Zero Apple II motherboard and not having a case for it. So I could believe people will spend a lot of money just to get this case.
Yeah. And that's what you're buying, really. I mean, like none of the rest of it even needs to be there. I think it probably would sell for equally much, but it's an interesting late date here. It says 4683, if I'm reading that correctly on the side, which means that this is the end of 1983. So this is, I think this is even after they were selling the Apple II Pluses. This is like a repair board.
Oh, interesting. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. They probably couldn't get the original Apple II board. So if it broke, then the technician put a 2 Plus in it. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it is interesting to see how poor the quality was on those early cases. Like they hadn't figured out the injection molding clearly because that case is just not well made at all.
Cool. All right. So there's that. We can watch what it goes for. It's an interesting novelty. I wouldn't expect anyone to buy it. This is a newer technology flash card reader. The only reason I put this up here is because I captioned it Badgie the Card Reader. I don't know if anyone has been watching Lower Decks, but this looks a lot like the sentient Starfleet badge.
It does. I loved newer technology. I think they still exist, actually. I was a fan of their stuff back in the day. And this is clearly from that period where the iMac had come out because it's got the partially translucent Bondi colored plastics and stuff.
All of a sudden, everything was Bondi blue.
So rounded. That'd be a CF card reader, I think, right? Given from its size?
I guess so, yeah. It doesn't say, which means that...
Flash, UFlash SM.
Yeah, smart media card reader. So it's probably... I mean, I suppose it could be an SD card.
My gut says CF card. That looks bigger. Okay. Judging when I look at the size of the USB thing, I mean, it's hard to tell, but... I think CF card.
You can see the connector through the clear white plastic in that previous shot. You can see it's a really wide, chunky connector, so that's definitely compact flash.
Okay.
You can see it right inside there, yeah.
Yeah, the connector for compact flash looks like an old PC card slot, like it's a big connector.
Yeah.
With like 500 pins in it.
Excellent.
I guess it's literally an IDE connector is what it is, because compact flash is IDE.
Which is super useful. I mean, I am very glad that that's how that worked out because you can just plug those things into old, you know, the right era drives.
Totally. That is a gift to backward compatibility. I replaced, I had a second gen iPod back when they had the little tiny hard drives in them. And I swapped the little tiny hard drive out for a compact flash. And it was literally plug and play. Open up the iPod, pull up the little tiny hard drive, put in a compact flash, and it just worked and doubled the storage of it. And
so now you could
like double the battery life because there was no longer a spinning disk inside it.
Right. And made it lighter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was a massive upgrade for iPods.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Next one. This is a sealed ColecoVision Atom high-speed digital data pack. And I just thought this was kind of interesting, just because, so the Coleco Atom had, it uses cassette storage, but this is, it's a special data cassette. And
I was going to say, isn't this just a cassette? What makes this a big deal? I don't understand Atom stuff.
You could buy data cassettes for like Commodores and stuff as well, because they were better made. Like they were like mainstream audio cassettes, especially towards the end, were, like we were talking about earlier, were pretty bad. Like the quality of them had dropped off a lot and they got way too unreliable for data. So this might be just a higher quality cassette.
But if you read your game in backwards, it would have like messages from Satan on it.
Right. Well, of course, yeah.
So this is it's pre-formatted, and I think from what I understand,
Chris just shakes her head at me the whole show.
So it turns out they're not entirely the same. Somewhere it's, I think if I search for interchangeable, yes, here we go. They're not directly interchangeable with normal cassettes because there's an extra hole in the case. So there's like some spike somewhere in the drive that will keep you from using like a regular cassette.
Terrible.
Yeah, so you have to drill a hole in your regular cassette to use it, but otherwise regular cassettes will work.
Okay, so Atom just did that as a, or Coleco just did that as a Gillette business model thing to force you to buy their fancy tapes.
A user oppressive thing. Nice.
That's terrible.
Okay, and then my last one, I captioned, nobody does cool like Microsoft. And this is a 20-year anniversary thing. It's let's see if I can bring up the photo here. It's a box that has something kind of like a word cloud, I guess. And it has a watch in it.
Oh, and this is terrible.
In 1975 we spoke only one language, and then in this little it's a not exactly a book, it's just like a fold out card, and the card says it was pretty basic, this one language that we all spoke. And then, you know, they go along talking about the stuff, but highlighting words that are Microsoft related. So operating within the system, it fogged up the windows. We spent every moment at the office. And it ends with, you know, but we know time will fly. At least now we have a watch, and you know, there's a watch in the thing. And somehow this just feels like it misfires at every opportunity.
Right? The design language here is terrible.
It's like that poster we looked at a while back, that Microsoft recruiting poster or whatever. Yeah. Same thing. It was like, it's like someone right at a design school that failed all their classes. Oh, it's terrible.
And also, colors. It's 1995, so it's right at the tail end of the whole Memphis design language. So you gather down, look, we got overlapping blocks of color and stuff like, but just, wow, what a first draft.
Yeah, the colors are awful. The proportions are weird. Like the colors don't even line up with the text properly. And then this word cloud thing is just a nightmare. What is that?
But you can tell that they were trying for something. I mean,
they were trying for something.
Yeah, they tried to make it cool. There's no question that's what they were going for.
Ooh, all right. Anyway, so there we go. That's it for my eBay auctions. So, not bad. I think we're coming in around 2 hours. So, I guess we're at closing discussions. Carrington, any closing thoughts?
I got nothing. My life has been so busy lately. I've been doing nothing. I cease to exist. So I'm not even here now. You can't see me.
Dealing with all the customers whose things are turning up all predictably black.
Dealing with that. Dealing with product launches for other things. My gal, bingo card, girlfriend, Czech, Canadian, etc. as a lot of people know, like she had fallen off a horse a while ago and broke ribs and punctured lung. But just in part of the recovery, getting back on the horse the very first time, got thrown by a new horse, then got stepped on by that horse, just like destroying her ankle. So we're still in many months of recovery of that. So
jeez. That's rough.
Yeah, just like, yeah.
I was about to congratulate her on literally getting back up on the horse.
On the horse, yeah. Right? And so now it's like trying to get back into being able to walk. Like, so just like, just horse just stepped right on her ankle, just powdered it. So lots of surgeries and still working through that. So I'm basically playing nurse. So
yeah,
no free time.
Sorry. Well, I hope that, ends up going better. Yeah,
it's going well so far. Like things are, weird. It's crazy, like you look at the x-ray, which is like amazing. It's like, and we, nowadays surgeons, they take, like, when you go in for surgery, they take pictures. And so the surgeon says, hey, you want to see the photos? And, like, airdrops me a bunch of photos of her, like, exploded ankle in middle surgery. I'm like, okay, cool. And Rachel's like, can I see them? I'm like, you do not want to see these. When you're through recovery, I will show you. This will hurt your recovery if you look at this. Oh. But it's, like, full-on, like, zombie nightmare. I'm like, you'll just send these to me, eh? Cool. Weird. But, yeah, it's just, like, yeah. But major rebuild. That. Yeah. But there you go. So, but it's crazy nowadays. You can just go in and they say, yeah, let's just rebuild this and we'll nail that together. And here's an artificial bit of this. And there you go. Just now she's already in a walking cast, has mobility back. I'm like, you had no ankle. Like, it was just, these were fully separated. Crazy. Just crazy what modern medicine can do. But yeah, it was hardcore damage this time. So,
when a surgeon offers to send you photos, the answer is always no.
No, it was yes. I've watched a lot of zombie movies. I'm like, yeah, you got to show it to me. I got to see. I can't not see. So
hard pass yeah. on that.
But when I went for, you know, you pass 50 and you go for a colonoscopy, and I was talking, I'm like, I gotta stay awake for this. Get a big video monitor. I'm like, I gotta watch. Like, it's gonna be so cool. Don't put me on a dock. I gotta see.
Well, they'll give you the video. I had a colonoscopy and they gave me the video.
I fell asleep because they had given me, but then later they gave me a DVD. I'm like, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I only got to see the very beginning, and then it's just, I was out. Yeah. I was like, darn it.
Movie night with the over 50s is not very fun.
Right? But it was not as much fun as watching live, though. I wanted to be there live for it. I would be like, keep going. Go till you see daylight.
Is that a secret door?
It totally would be. I don't know. Internal stuff I find very cool. So anyway, so that's what I've been doing. Mostly just be a nurse.
Was that a reference to, like, the wall in Doom or whatever? where it sort of looks like a slightly different texture?
Yeah, I was imagining, like, any sort of dungeon crawl, you know, there's going to be passages and things. Yeah. That is certainly what my colonoscopy video looked like. It was just a weird gray.
I'm remarkably pale inside. You think inside is going to be super, like, red. And I was like, I'm so fish colored. I'm fish colored out here too, but for some reason I thought insides were more red. I was like, oh, it's so pale.
Well, it's the lighting, right? They have bright white LED light. I'm serious. So they have a very bright white LED light so they can see what they're doing in there. It's not like you have natural sunlight in there to compare with.
I do, though. I do. I'm made of star stuff.
All right.
Okay, Kyle.
Quinn, any closing notes?
Sorry, we're so far off the rails.
Yeah, Quinn, follow that.
What podcast is this? Yeah, no, I also have not sadly been doing much retro stuff. I did have my own sports-related injury, though. I've been relearning how to ice skate because I moved back to Canada and, you know, went in Rome. So, and I haven't ice skated in 25 years. And turns out falling on ice when you're 47 is a very different experience than falling on ice when you're 15 and you're indestructible. And so in the first 30 minutes, I fell and landed on my chin and got a giant welt and a mild concussion. So I was like, well, sure glad I did this.
Yeah.
So I had spent some time recovering from that. But yeah, otherwise I'm still trying to rearrange my office to get some retro stuff in here. I've got the desks in a different area now that's giving me more space. So hopefully that is still my intent, is to get my retro machines back up in here, but it has not happened yet.
Yeah. I do sort of think that if I try skating or sledding or whatever again, I'm gonna try to go for the like whatever the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man look.
Yeah, I think I might honestly get a helmet because I see a lot of the older folks wearing helmets, and there's no shame in that because as I said, when you fall when you're old, it's a whole different ball game. Like, you hurt things that kids just bounce right back up. And
you need those vests that like puff out when you fall, like off a motorcycle. You need those
things. Like motorcycle airbags. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, at least some gloves and a helmet are not a terrible idea, just so that when you fall you don't hurt yourself quite so badly. But it's harder than I remember ice skating. It's not easy.
So laptops can know if they're falling, right? I mean, like, they can quickly shut off the hard drive, so you could.
Nowadays,
you could
an
wear
Apple
something.
Watch can know when you're falling, so it could just signal things. I guess you're going down.
Your phone knows too. If you go in for service, if the accelerometer records big impacts, and Apple can deny you service if they decide your phone was dropped really badly, which is a dirty little secret of the Genius Bar. They also have water sensors in them, which I think more people are aware of that they have a water sensor in them. So if they find your phone was dunked, they also will deny warranty.
Yeah. not cool.
Yeah.
Well, maybe fair, potentially fair, but.
Yeah. Although nowadays, now that they're waterproof, they still have water sensors in them, but now it's just a software warning. Have you guys ever seen this? I took my phone in a hot tub a while back, and it worked fine, of course, because it's waterproof. It's a modern iPhone. Mm-hmm. But afterwards, I couldn't charge it because there was water in the charging port, in the lightning port.
Oh, interesting.
And when I plugged in the cable, a little message came up saying, hey, we've detected water in the port, so you have to wait before you can charge. So I was like, oh, that's neat. And I waited a couple hours, and then it worked. So
that's cool. The only thing I've had like that is when my Apple Watch, older one, got wet that one time, and it has that thing where you spin the dial to shoot out the water.
Yeah, I was just going
to
say.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and the speaker on the phone does that
vibrates
too. The speaker vibrates to shoot the water out of the speaker holes, which is
that really motivated me to dunk it in the water a lot more. So I don't know if that was a good idea. So
I bet.
Yeah, I haven't yet tried that out on the watch, but I did see that there's something you can do to like expel the water, which just seems weird. But and for me, I also really haven't been doing very much that counts as retro, but in the I guess sort of fits in these notes. Cyber Ears is going away, so that intro that everybody knows.
We will soon have limited bandwidth.
Yeah,
it won't be my audio and my terms anymore.
Yeah. Also, we discovered that the forum link on the site is no longer leads to where it goes, and so it isn't in fact at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. And who knows, it might not have been there for years.
For quite a while.
It's now at maybe I'll fix the outro.
Sure.
It has been fixed on the site though.
Yeah, but Cyber Ears has been great to us, to us. So it's sad that it's going away because it has truly been just rock solid and perfect. So it's sad.
But so now I guess we will soon switch to another provider. It's possible that that provider will be hosting this episode when it hits the feed. Who knows?
Well, you'll know when it happens when you look in your feed and you see all our shows.
270 new episodes.
Suddenly look like they're new again.
Yeah. Sorry.
Can't touch a podcast feed without that happening.
It's literally impossible to touch a podcast feed cleanly. Yeah. It's never, ever happened in the history of podcasts.
We were planning on switching to a different host, like a CMS host as well. So I probably will try to do that at the same time so that at least, the deluge happens only once.
But even the pros have that problem. Like a couple of months ago, I opened my feed and every episode of This American Life was sitting there. And clearly they changed something on their feed. And it
I have moved my podcast feeds many times and I've never had that problem. It's not, you just got to know how the XML is formatted. It's not that hard. But nobody does it by hand. Like, I do my RSS feed by hand.
Yeah, so you have all the UUIDs or whatever the same.
Yeah, exactly. But the key is I just do it manually. I literally do manual XML every time. It's worked great for me. It's easy peasy.
If we do have a problem, blame Carrington.
100%.
He clearly knows how to do it.
Right. Yep. It's possible, and yet it didn't happen. So
we've already moved. Yeah. So it's easy.
Oh, the move has already happened.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And it was perfect. It was seamless.
Apparently it was. I didn't know.
And it happened during this show.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, I think that's probably about it, though. Is that all I was going to say? I think it is. So that's it for the show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at https://forum.vcfed.org/index.php?forums/retro-podcast-discussion.81/. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And please write a review on iTunes if you wish. And until next time,
retro confused.
Gotta get myself.